Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode contains distressing themes and descriptions of sexual violence. This podcast is intended for a mature audience. Listener caution is advised. Tony Wesson was looking forward to spending time with his fiancée, Suzanne. They both enjoyed working out at the local leisure club, and weightlifting was the perfect way to blow off some steam at 6 p.m. on a Friday evening. It was July 1st, 1988, and the sun was still shining over Tewkesbury Walk in the Shaftesbury area of Newport, Wales. Despite the nice weather, the curtains were closed inside Suzanne's home. Using the key that Suzanne had given him, Tony unlocked the door to the flat and walked inside. The only light in the hall came from the sunbeams that shone through the bathroom window across from Suzanne's bedroom. The rays of light drew Tony's attention to something on the bedroom door. A bloodstain. Welcome to Season 9, Episode 5 of They Walk Among Us, a podcast dedicated to UK true crime. ...24-year-old Tony Wesson met 20-year-old Suzanne Greenhill at Lady Hill Deaf Club 2 years earlier in 1986. The majority of the couple's social circle was also hearing impaired. After several years of happily dating, Tony felt it was time to propose to Suzanne. It went as planned. Suzanne accepted immediately, proudly wearing the ring Tony had given her. They were young, in love, and excited for the future. Tony was still living at home with his parents. However, Suzanne had been living in her own flat with her cat for the last 2 years, so Tony often stayed at her place. Suzanne was independent. She seldom asked for help, but when she did, it was a necessity. For assistance with phone calls, she knew she could rely on her neighbours. In June 1988, Suzanne completed a sewing machinist course at the Skills Centre to enhance her credentials and employability. She planned to work in the textile industry, but ambitions of a new career and marriage were cruelly erased at the end of that month. After letting himself in to Suzanne's flat on July 1st, Tony was confronted with the sight of blood. When he opened the bedroom door, Tony saw Suzanne's bare legs on the floor beside the bed. A large pool of blood surrounded Suzanne's half-naked body, soaking her tracksuit bottoms that had been pulled down to her ankles. Tony screamed in horror and stepped into the kitchen as he tried to comprehend what he was seeing. Hoping that it was just a bad dream, Tony chanced going back to the bedroom, but seeing Suzanne's body made him fall to his knees. He reached out and brushed her chestnut brown hair from her face. A strip of tape covered Suzanne's eyes. Something was inside her mouth, and there was a cut and bruises beneath her lip. She had deep wounds to the front of her neck. Tony ran out of the flat and knocked on the front door of Suzanne's neighbors. Hazel King had heard the key turning in Suzanne's latch a few minutes earlier, but she had no idea that the howling sound she heard had come from Tony. Communicating with people who could hear was sometimes challenging, and considering the circumstances, Tony's speech was slightly more difficult to understand. In a state of distress and shock, he desperately tried to ask Hazel for help and tell her that Suzanne had been stabbed. Frustrated that Suzanne's neighbor did not understand, Tony ran to his parents and told them what had happened. By the time he returned to the flat, one of Suzanne's neighbors had gone inside the property and in turn phoned the police. Investigators from Gwent CID arrived at Suzanne's flat soon after. Scenes of crime officers photographed and videotaped the interior of the property. Detectives tried to speak to Tony, who was outside on his knees with his head in his hands. Initially, there was a communication barrier, but sign language interpreters were called in to assist with the investigation. In the bedroom, Suzanne's body lay between her bed and a cupboard. It was clear that she had bled profusely from stab wounds to her neck, and although she did not seem to have moved during the attack, there were bloody footprints on the kitchen and bathroom floor. There were no signs of a struggle, and injuries on Suzanne's face were consistent with her being knocked unconscious or stunned by a powerful blow. Investigators believe she had been immobilized before her attacker deprived her of sight by blindfolding her with a strip of medical plaster and prevented her from screaming by stuffing underwear into her mouth. Her tracksuit bottoms had been pulled down and her bra had been pushed up, indicating that she had been sexually assaulted. Without any evidence of a break-in, investigators assume that Suzanne had either known her attacker enough to let them inside, or they had come in through an unlocked window. While officers searched Suzanne's flat for a murder weapon, her remains were taken to the mortuary for a post-mortem examination. Home office pathologist Dr. Richard Kellett conducted the exam. He found 6 stab wounds to Suzanne's throat. 5 of the wounds were 6 to 8 centimeters deep and almost went through her neck, but the fatal wound was a 1.5 centimeter cut that had perforated her carotid artery, causing her to bleed out in less than 2 minutes. There was also a single stab wound found on Suzanne's back, but there was no evidence of any defensive wounds. The pathologist believed that the injuries were consistent with Suzanne lying still on the floor while her attacker stood over her. Dr. Kellett was of the opinion that Suzanne had been killed up to 3 days before her body was found. As members of Gwent Police canvassed the Shaftesbury area of Newport, tracker dogs were brought in to search the surrounding location for the knife that was used to kill Suzanne. After the post-mortem, the pathologist concluded that the murder weapon was likely a 5-inch blade. While scenes of crime officers continued to collect evidence from Suzanne's flat, Home Office forensic scientist Stephen Green analysed blood that was found throughout the home. It appeared as though Suzanne's killer had taken the time to clean themselves off in the bathroom, and they had removed their shoes at some point after the murder, leaving bloody stocking imprints on the tiles. A number of tape lifts from Suzanne's body had collected unidentified red fibres, which could not be linked to any items in her flat. Swabs taken from Suzanne's genitals had collected sperm cells. However, in 1988, DNA profiling was still in its infancy, so the evidence was of no use at the time. A murder inquiry was launched by Detective Chief Superintendent Mark Waters, head of Gwent CID. Over 30 officers were assigned to the case, and DCS Waters was quick to tell the media that he suspected there was a sexual motive behind Suzanne Greenhill's murder. The detective added, "This was not a frenzied attack. They are quite deliberate stabbings, but we are not saying how many wounds there were. We found no sign of forced entry to Suzanne's flat, and the occupants of other flats in the block heard no sound of a disturbance. It is likely the person responsible left heavily bloodstained." The police appealed to anyone who saw Suzanne in the days before her body was discovered. She had had short blonde hair, but a week before her death she had dyed it brown. Despite using cutting-edge technology to find fingerprints in Suzanne's flat, investigators could only base their description of her killer on the injuries he had inflicted. DCS Waters said, "Her attacker must have been powerfully built and possibly used to using his fists." Interviews with Suzanne's friends took longer to arrange because of the need for sign language interpreters to be present. Investigators were also concerned that television appeals were going unnoticed by people in Newport, as the majority of residents had their TV aerials tuned to receive English-speaking channels broadcast from Bristol. Social workers who specialised in assisting people with hearing impairments were also contacted to help the police interview people close to Suzanne. One of the social workers, Wynne Davis, was brought to the local station late on Friday, July 1st to translate during interviews. When he arrived home later that night, his wife said he was upset over the details of the murder, and he contacted his doctor to request that he be hospitalised. Wynne suffered from severe depression in the past and accidentally overdosed the following day. DCS Waters said, "I asked for his professional advice along with others. He gave me some assistance interviewing someone on Friday night. He did not appear distressed as a result of that. He seemed to be a very dedicated, caring person who was very concerned about something like this happening in the deaf community." 10 days after Suzanne Greenhill's body was found in her flat, a funeral was held at Lisswherry Baptist Church in Newport. Suzanne's devastated fiancé walked behind her casket as it was carried into the church. Over 200 mourners lined the pews while the service was delivered and translated into sign language. It was an unusual case. The police had little experience using sign language interpreters, and Suzanne's popularity made the investigation more complex than initially expected, especially due to the availability of interpreters on a large scale. Suzanne had travelled to meetups with friends in South Wales and Bristol. By the end of July, the police announced that they were looking for a man witnesses reported seeing with Suzanne on several occasions. Detective Chief Inspector Bill Glynn described the individual as 40 to 50 years old, with tight, curly hair that was turning grey. He had a pockmarked complexion. The person of interest was seen communicating with Suzanne in sign language. DCI Glynn told the press, "We've had a number of sightings of this man with the deceased from different witnesses but have been unable to identify him so far, though we will eventually. He's been seen in Sainsbury's shopping with her, which indicates a close relationship, and on the bus going there with her on different occasions. He was also with her at Mice Glass Industrial Estate, where he talked to a hot dog salesman and bought food for her after asking her in sign language what she wanted. This man keeps cropping up on our computer checks. It may be that he has nothing to do with her death. Even so, if the relationship was as close as it seems to have been, this man will have knowledge of her movements and habits that could be vital in our search for her murderer. We urge him to come forward so that we can eliminate him from our inquiries." A photo fit of the man was shown to Suzanne's friends and family, but no one recognised the suspect. The police also announced that they were trying to trace a couple who were seen fighting outside of the entrance to Suzanne's flat at around 9 p.m. on June 29th. DCS Waters remarked, "The couple were apparently having an argument by a wall at the Sainsbury's store site. We would be grateful if they would come forward because any information at all they have could be useful." The council flats where Suzanne had been living for 2 years were connected by communal walkways, and the ground surrounding the property contained large bushes and trees that neighbours feared provided cover for anyone lurking at night. Suzanne's front door was concealed by an overgrown hedge, so her neighbours would not have seen anyone trying to enter. According to Suzanne's neighbour, Josephine Logan, "Suzanne was out every evening around midnight looking for her cat. She just used to leave her door open or on the latch. Anybody could have slipped into the house while she was not looking." The investigating officers advise women living alone in the area to take extra precautions to ensure their safety. DCS Waters stated, "Because it was such a nasty crime and because of its sexual nature, there is always a real threat this man could attack again. If women are worried, they should contact their local crime prevention officer. We have already had women coming forward since this murder. I would advise them to make sure their windows are secure and not to answer their front door unless they know who is there." Waters asked the public to try to remember if they saw anyone with bloodstains on their clothes around June 29th. Speaking about the person responsible, the detective added, "If he lives with anybody such as his family, then they must be suspicious. We would appeal for anyone with information to get in touch with us in confidence." In August, the police announced they were trying to trace people who had bought a specific roll of adhesive plaster. DCS Waters spoke at a press conference and explained that 3 rolls of Fast-Aid 5cm zinc oxide plaster produced by Robinson had been purchased in the weeks before Suzanne's murder. The strip of tape found over Suzanne's eyes had not come from her home, so investigators believe that the killer had brought it with them. DCS Waters told the press, "It's a rare type of tape that retails for £1.80 and might be used to strap injuries or for sport. We urgently want to hear from anyone who bought it in the Malpas or Bettis area in the last 3 months." The older man seen with Suzanne had still not been identified, but the police believed he was from the Pishgwently area of Newport. He could be deaf or perhaps not, but he seemed to be proficient in sign language. In an effort to use one of the only pieces of evidence left by the killer, DCS Waters travelled to St Thomas Hospital in London to speak with Professor of Anatomy Mike Day. Waters said, "He has been studying some footprints and marks we found at the scene. which we hope will enable him to build up a profile of this man to give us his approximate height, weight, and age. It's like the last piece in a jigsaw picture of the man we believe to be Suzanne's killer. We hope it can give us a major lead on a man we believe to be local, who hasn't come forward despite all the publicity. He's obviously keeping a low profile, whatever his connection with the deceased. If he's frightened to come forward for any reason, he can still contact us confidentially. Later that month, Professor Day concluded that the footprints had been made by someone with small feet wearing nylon socks. Detective Chief Inspector Bill Glynn told reporters, "The shoe size was between 4 or 5, which would have put the person's height at no more than 5 feet 3 inches. Whoever was in the flat was an unusually small person, which leads us to believe it may be a teenager aged between 14 and 17 years old. This is a very significant find because it narrows down our search." Investigators shifted their focus from the older man witnesses claimed to have seen with Suzanne to younger men and teenage boys in the area. On September 8, 1988, Crime Watch aired a segment on Suzanne Greenhill's case. Subtitles and a sign language interpreter were shown on screen, and a phone number for deaf or hard of hearing people was set up to allow them to pass on information. Two months later, while clearing out her flat, Suzanne's family noticed that a teddy she had been given before her grandparents' death was missing. The cuddly toy was described as being a 10-inch pink mouse. Gwent Police spokeswoman Anne Tilley said, "Her parents say she wouldn't have given it to anybody because she was so attached to it. As far as we are aware, it is the only thing that is missing." Investigators considered the possibility that a child had been present at the time of the murder, which would explain the small footprints and who had taken the teddy. Detective Inspector Alan Watkins added, "We can't rule out the possibility that the killer might have taken it, but anyone given this toy might have it quite innocently and legitimately." In January 1989, a man who had worked in Newport at the time of Suzanne Greenhill's death came forward with information about a new suspect. The witness's friend had recently moved into Suzanne's old flat, and while talking about her murder, the man realized he had been one of the last people to see her alive. He had been working at Burlington's Cafe in Upper Dock Street at around 4 p.m. on June 29th and recalled seeing Suzanne with a tall, thin man in his 20s with brown or blonde hair. They were communicating in sign language. DCS Waters said, "The witness and his friend were talking about the killing in the flat, and it made the Bristol man remember that he had seen a girl who looked like Suzanne in the cafe on the day she was killed. It is an incredible coincidence, but one that I'm grateful happened. The witness is a very sensible lad. This man is not necessarily our killer. If we can find out who he was, then it might lead us to the real murderer." A man matching that description had been seen standing in the dark outside Suzanne's flat at around 11:30 p.m. that night. Waters added, "This man may be completely innocent, but as with others, we need to talk to him to build up a complete picture of Suzanne's movements in the weeks before she died." According to the police, Suzanne had told a friend that she had a blonde boyfriend who she had been to visit at Adrian Bolt Green Flats in April of that year. The description also matched that of a man who entered Jeff's Fish Bar in Cross Keys the night of the murder. Blood was seen on the man's arms and clothes, and the woman who served him initially thought he had been drinking because she struggled to understand him due to a speech impediment. Asking that this man contact the police, DCS Waters went on to say, "We don't know that those are one and the same person, but we need them and anyone else with information about her movements to come forward so we can eliminate them from our inquiries." A team of 18 investigators had conducted over 4,500 interviews and taken over 300 statements in the 6 months since Suzanne's death. However, DCS Waters felt that someone was withholding information. "I have been disappointed with the public response so far, but we are determined and optimistic that we'll get the killer in the end." The detectives were convinced that Suzanne had been killed by someone who knew her, so they continued to speak with her in a circle to establish if she had any enemies. Suzanne's life revolved around spending time with her fiancé Tony Wesson, visiting her family, and socialising with other members of the local death club. Tony had last seen Suzanne on Tuesday, June 28, 1988. They had been to the leisure club together, and after going to a friend, Suzanne had walked home alone. Tony said Suzanne had been her usual bubbly self. Just a few days earlier, they had gone to Porthcawl Beach with another couple, Timothy and Tracy Robson. 28-year-old Timothy Robson and his wife lived on Gaira Park Drive in Newport, and moved in the same social circle as Suzanne and Tony. Robson had lost his hearing following an accident when he was 3 years old. He could lip read and knew some sign language. He regularly played snooker and said that on the night Suzanne was killed, he was at a tournament at the Gaira Club. But people at the snooker hall didn't remember seeing him. Robson had a reputation for having a temper, and when the police visited his home, they noticed tension between him and his wife. Their relationship subsequently broke down, and when investigators spoke to Tracy, she confessed that Robson had come home in a state of distress on the night in question. That evening, he had told her that he was going to see a friend and had asked her to get his red rugby sweater and grey trousers. Tracy remembered Robson coming home after 11:30 p.m. and he had 3 scratch marks on the side of his face. She tried to ask him what had happened, but he was too wound up to talk. Tracy also noticed red stains on Robson's jumper, trousers, and trainers. He stripped off and put his clothes straight into the washing machine, which he had never done before. When he calmed down, Robson told his wife he had been in a pub when a woman approached him. He claimed that he had told her he was married, but another man came over, and they got into an argument about a spilt drink. Robson told Tracy he had hit them both, and then ran home a different way to avoid the police. He asked her not to tell anyone about the fight, including her mother. Tracy revealed to the police that at that point, Robson was shaking all over, and his hand looked red and swollen. Investigators spoke with Robson's friends and co-workers, who recalled seeing him with scratches on his face, but they said he had told them that his wife had scratched him during an argument. Robson had told others he had fallen off a bar stool or hurt his face at work. Furthermore, Robson matched the description of the blood-stained man seen in the fish and chip shop on the night Suzanne was killed.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
On the morning of February 1st, 1989, investigators traveled to Timothy Robson's house and arrested him on suspicion of murdering Suzanne Greenhill. While he was being transported to Mindy Police Station, his home was searched. In the wardrobe, they saw a locked cash box. When it was opened, they found Robson's birth certificate, his marriage certificate, and some keys attached to a keyring with a leather fob. The fob was identified as belonging to Suzanne Greenhill. She had lost her keys shortly before she was killed, but the key to her flat was not found during the search. The suitcase in Robson's bedroom contained a newspaper clipping of an article published in July 1988 titled, "Club Regulars Could Hold Murder Clue." The article was about Suzanne's murder. What's more, artwork from the Iron Maiden single Sanctuary was found, which depicted the band's mascot Eddie with a knife standing over the blindfolded body of former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Investigators couldn't help but notice the similarities between the cover art and Suzanne's murder scene. The clothes Robson had been wearing on the night Suzanne was killed were also collected, and the fibers from his red sweater were compared to the fibers found on Suzanne's body. They were identical, as were his footprints. He wore a size 5 shoe. Robson was interviewed with the assistance of a sign language interpreter, but denied any involvement in Suzanne's murder and insisted he had been out playing snooker. On February 6, 1989, Timothy Jack Robson was charged with Suzanne Greenhill's murder. At a hearing, his counsel requested that the reporting restrictions in place be lifted, as Robson wanted to publicly announce his innocence. He also wanted more witnesses to come forward, and for the police to stop badgering his parents. Ian Griffiths, acting for the Crown, told the court that the prosecution would not be ready for trial for some time, as there was still a lot of forensic evidence to be examined. Robson's application for bail was denied, after the prosecution opposed the motion due to threats to the defendant's safety. The trial finally got underway at Cardiff Crown Court in October of that year. A number of sign language interpreters had to attend, but they needed to understand the proceedings in a legal sense to translate to the defendant and at least 10 of the witnesses. Robson's counsel, Dudley Harmston, said there would need to be double translations throughout the trial. He added, "We are going to have the situation where one of the deaf witnesses will make a statement which has to be interpreted for the court and then reinterpreted for the defendant. The concern is that evidence could get distorted in the translations. It's not just hearing but understanding, and with some of the legal and forensic evidence, I can see difficulties arising." Opening for the Crown, Philip Price QC told the jury that Tony Wesson had discovered his fiancée's body in her flat on July 1, 1988. Price told the court, "A woman found him cradling his head in his hands, making howling noises. When neighbours went inside to see what had made Tony so distraught, they too saw Suzanne's nearly naked body in a pool of blood on the bedroom floor." Speaking about the medical tape that had been placed over Suzanne's eyes, the prosecutor said, "The feature of horror is that, of course, this blindfold cut off the principal sense left to her. Whether the purpose was to prevent her recognizing her attacker, or for some macabre sexual gratification, only the murderer can tell us for certain." The prosecution alleged that there was a sexual motive behind the murder, corroborated not only by Suzanne's state of undress, but also by evidence of a sexual offence. During his testimony, Tony Wesson said that Robson had tried to comfort him after Suzanne's death and had been a good friend to both of them. Frustratingly for all involved, less than a week into the trial, the jury was discharged. Mr. Justice Roche told the court, "Certain matters have come to the attention of the court in which it is not necessary for me to enlarge further." Details of why the legal proceedings were brought to a halt have never been publicly disclosed. The trial restarted with a new jury the following week, and Tony Wesson had to relive the horror of finding Suzanne's body again. At one point during cross-examination by the defence, Tony became overwhelmed and upset. "You've gone too far. I don't want to talk about it. It's hurting me." The judge intervened and told the defendant's barrister that he hoped a relevant point would emerge, as the witness had already given his account multiple times. Surprisingly, the trial was again adjourned, but this time it was only for a few days as a juror's husband was hospitalised. When the proceedings began again, Robson's ex-wife, who had since divorced him, testified for the prosecution. Tracy Robson said she knew Suzanne Greenhill as her husband was friends with Tony Wesson, and they had gone out together before. On the night Suzanne was murdered, Tracy said that Robson went out wearing a red sweater, grey trousers, and a pair of trainers. When he got home, there were bloodstains on his clothes. "He was shaking, trembling. I couldn't understand him," Tracy testified. "I'd never seen anything like it before. It was the first time." She went to bed alone, and when she woke up at 3 a.m. she found Robson asleep in front of the television. According to Tracy, her husband was very quiet the next day. 2 weeks into the second trial, after evidence from 65 witnesses had been presented, Timothy Robson's counsel withdrew from the case. The judge told the jury that they should not speculate as to why the barrister quit or let it affect their judgment. But after a few days without finding Robson a suitable replacement, the second jury were discharged. The trial was set to restart for a third time the following year. By this point, advances in DNA technology meant that sperm cells found during Suzanne's post-mortem could be compared to a sample given by Timothy Robson. When he was confronted with the fact that his DNA matched the evidence on Suzanne's body, he changed his account. In January 1990, Robson told the police that on the night of the murder, he had gone to a local club to play snooker, but there were not enough people there, so he left. He said that Suzanne had told him she wanted to speak to him, so he called at her flat, and she let him in through the back patio door. Robson claimed that they watched TV together before having a conversation about Suzanne and Tony's relationship. During Robson's third trial in February, he testified, "I'm very serious now. She wanted me to tell Tony that she wanted to finish with him. I asked her why and she said there were rows. I told her that I could not tell him and that she would have to do it herself, but she said she was afraid. I didn't know what was going on." Robson alleged that Suzanne told him she wanted to have sex with him. He claimed they had slept together at his house on three occasions, and he had not previously provided any information about their sexual relationship because he thought the police would think he killed Suzanne. According to Robson, he told Suzanne that he did not want to have sex because he was married and was worried that Tony would catch them. He said that Suzanne then started crying and sat on the floor before pulling him down to have sex. Robson claimed that he left Suzanne's flat at 10:20 p.m. and insisted that she was still alive at that point. He then went to a nearby pub where he got into an argument with someone. After the man tried to hit him, Robson fell over and ran home. Robson's counsel, Martin Thomas, highlighted what he believed were inconsistencies in the prosecution's case. The day after the Crown were arguing Suzanne had been murdered by the defendant, several witnesses claimed to have seen her alive and well in Newport. Terry Ann Yandel, who went to Bettis Comprehensive School with Suzanne, said that she had met her in the town centre and they discussed her wedding plans. Other witnesses included a Sainsbury's employee who said they saw Suzanne shopping, and a mechanic who said his colleagues had whistled at a woman matching Suzanne's description. On February 21st, 1990, the jury returned with a verdict. Their unanimous decision was relayed to Timothy Robson through a sign language interpreter. As the foreman announced that Robson had been found guilty of murder, the defendant showed no emotion. Mr. Justice Jowett told Robson that the murder had been committed out of lustful desire. Timothy Robson was sentenced to life in prison with a minimum term of 25 years. So where are we now? In March 1992, just under 2.5 years after the first set of legal proceedings, the Court of Appeal ruled on Timothy Robson's conviction. The appeal court found issues with the judge's remarks, which they felt left the defense at a disadvantage. The verdict was deemed unsafe, and the appeal judges ordered it to be vacated. Robson's counsel requested that his client be released immediately without a retrial, but Lord Justice Taylor, one of the judges, said murder is a nasty business. Timothy Robson's murder trial started for a fourth time 4 months later. After 45 minutes of deliberations, the jury returned, finding him guilty once more. Robson's face remained unchanged as the verdict was relayed to him, but his mother Joanne cried out "Never" from the public gallery. Outside the courtroom, Detective Inspector Des James said, "It has been a very long inquiry, but justice has been done." Five years later, Channel 4 aired an episode of Trial and Error Live based on the case. The program's premise was to check whether the conviction was safe. After the show aired, Timothy Robson's mother, Joanne, told Wales on Sunday that she had received a phone call with new information. "He told me his name and the name of the man he said did it. He told me that he had evidence of who had done it. He told me he had been in Suzanne's flat himself. It shocked me. I am hoping this will help prove that Tim is innocent, like he has said all along." After the lengthy inquiry and subsequent proceedings, Gwent police had no doubt they had caught the right man. A spokesperson told Wales on Sunday, "We are satisfied that Tim Robson has been convicted in the due course of the law." Thank you for listening. A special thanks to our new Patreon producer, Lil, and all our patrons for their support. For more information on this episode, please see the show notes or visit our website, theywalkamonguspodcast.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.